You're listening to a sermon from New Harvest Church in Salem, Oregon. We believe that you were created for connection to Christ and a community of his followers. This sermon is an extension of our desire to become more like Christ by engaging God's word within our weekly gatherings. If you are in the area, we'd love for you to join us on a Sunday. You can learn more about New Harvest and our ministries at newharvestch.org.
This morning, we want to start off, before we head into the message, by kind of looking at the question of how do you navigate life today? How do you kind of handle family life, for those of you with kids at home? And how can you still be a Christian who cares about other people and wants to reach out beyond your family and your little sphere of where you are? And so I asked David and Anna Neely to kind of share, what has it been like at your home? How are you navigating this? What does it look like to love your neighbor? And so they put together a little video that you're going to watch right now that kind of set up the topic that we're going to be looking at. Here's David and Anna.
Like it has been for a lot of people, COVID's been a very interesting, worrisome time for us. It's also been a really good time for us to connect as a family. At the beginning of COVID, it was extra worrisome because about a week before the stay-at-home order even happened, we were self-isolating because I had been out in public doing hands-on training with people and I had gotten sick. And of course, our minds obviously went to, you know, kind of the scariest place possible with everything that's going on in the news. It was really unavoidable. And it was really hard in that time to be experiencing, you know, some symptoms that were later on obviously deemed not our biggest fear, but to when we really needed it the most to have our support system taken away from us in the stay-at-home order. We had a lot of social groups that we went to, and having them canceled was something that had a huge impact on not just us, but kind of the Neelys as a family.
Yeah. Some of the things that we immediately started implementing was checking with our family members who are medically fragile, as well as our neighbors, just to see if we could get them anything while we were out helping ourselves to get ready to not leave. As David said, some of our groups were canceled. For me and the kids specifically, it was our MOPS group. With that, the leaders decided to get together and meet in a parking lot and sit in our trunks and just be able to spend time together and figure out how we can really support the local young moms in our community. With that, we found out that we could actually social distance but share love to them by writing words of hope on their sidewalks in front of their houses. Another one was our community group, where we still are doing Zoom meetings. Some of the other things is just spending the extra time that we have talking to family members. I specifically have been carving out time to really talk to David's sister, who is an ICU nurse, just about other stuff besides what is her daily normal life right now. One of the last things that we've been doing is just when we are going to the store, just making sure that we are checking in with other moms and other families to see if we can pick up anything from them at that store.
Like we've kind of said a little bit, being socially isolated has been very hard on us. About the second or third weekend, I don't remember which one it was, Hattie, our daughter, our oldest, came to Anna and said, "Mom, do I still have friends?" It was really hard to hear our 3.5-year-old ask if she still had friends, you know, kind of in light of everything that's going on right now. And how hard is it to explain that, you know, we're doing all of these things for our community to keep each other safe and to make sure that we are all staying healthy. But we have been looking at the bigger picture and what that means for people. As Anna alluded to earlier, I have not just the one sister, but I have two sisters along with their husbands who all work hands-on daily with COVID patients. They are, you know, always concerned about, number one, being at work, and then two, you know, them coming home. They have families that they're with. So, you know, they have those daily struggles. And these are things we're going to see where the level of worry that they have about going to work is something that's going to last probably far beyond what's happening right now, even directly with COVID. And, you know, so for us, even though it's very, very hard to be disconnected socially from our groups, we know that really some of the best things that we can be doing right now are social distancing. But that doesn't mean that we can't be connected. You know, like Anna said, she's still doing meeting with MOPS via Zoom meetings. I still get to meet with our middle school kids via Zoom meetings. We get to do the same thing with our community group. Our community group, after a little hiatus, I think, of everybody trying to get back to some level of homeostasis, has begun to meet on Zoom too. So overall, I think that for us, though, yes, it has been very hard, we're happy to make sure that we're taking care, not just of ourselves, but for the people that really need us to stay at home to keep each other safe most, while not losing any of those relationships. So I hope that you guys are able to do the same thing. And we're really looking forward to when we can get back together, seeing all of you. I don't know what level of physical interaction we're going to be allowed to have, but the second they say the hugging is back on, you guys come and find me. But we'll see you. We'll see you around, and whatever that may be, anytime soon. Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks to David and Anna for sharing that. David's actually back here this morning playing drums, but you got to watch him and have his wife join him for that video. And I think what they shared about really sets up what I'd like to talk about this morning really well. I guess I should introduce myself. Most of you know me, but for those of you who aren't typically a part of our church on Sundays, my name is Tyler. I'm one of the pastors here at New Harvest, and glad for you to be joining us wherever you are. If you're in Salem or somewhere around the world or in the United States, thanks for letting us into your living room or on your phone or computer or however you're watching. We are about a month into this, whatever you want to call this new way of life is. We're about a month into it. And I was kind of processing through this week all the different aspects to the story of this new kind of normal way of living, or this season of life. It is in part like a technology story. All of these online retailers like Amazon, like Walmart, like eBay, they're all just overrun on their online side of their business. And so FedEx and UPS and USPS are working all overtime or all hiring extra people. In fact, like last week, we got an Amazon package at my house, and it was just some random guy in his car who pulls out a package and walks up to my door and places it. And I said to my wife, like, who just gave us a package? What's going on? Well, apparently the guy worked for Amazon, and they've hired just regular people to drive their cars and deliver packages all day. We have adjusted the way that we're doing school. Many of you are working differently. How we maintain friendships and family relationships and even do church is all through technology. And so it's in part a technology story. It's also an economic story. Many of you have lost income, have lost jobs. There's 300,000 people in the state of Oregon who have filed for unemployment in the last month. 300,000 people. And in the United States, it's 6 million. And some economic experts believe that we could be looking at the highest unemployment rate that we've had in almost 100 years. And so it's an economic story. It could be that we look back on this and this was just a blip on the radar. It could be that we're headed into a recession or even a much greater depression type situation. Nobody knows. It's impossible to know. We don't really know what the future holds economically. Our government has put up trillions of dollars to try and keep the economy going, and we don't even know if it's enough. And so it's an economic story, what's happening right now. It's also a local story. It's obviously an international thing. This is affecting everybody all over the entire world. But it's a local story, meaning that we're really fixated on things that are happening right here in our city of Salem. And so I think about something that just happened 2 weeks ago. Salem Health, which runs the Salem Hospital and a lot of clinics in the Salem area in Marion County, put out a kind of notice to people through social media and through their website and communication channels that they needed masks. They had all these kits, but they needed people, just regular people like you and me, to put together these masks. And so they had kits, and they put out a time, hey, these are going to be available for you to pick up on two different days for a few hours. You can come and get these. Well, the response was overwhelming, and they got rid of all of the kits that they had put together to give out in 30 minutes. And the Salem police were called in because there was this huge traffic jam over on Mission Street by Kmart. They were called in to try and steer traffic to mitigate the damage that was happening from all the cars that had shown up to try and pick up kits. And so it's a local story. We care about what's happening right here in our city. And then this is also a social story. I've been at the park a lot because that's where I've gone to exercise over the last few weeks and go on a run. And I've just noticed like the way that when I'm around other people, the way they interact with me is different. First of all, they make sure they're staying a really good distance away from me. Second of all, they're much more friendly. People smile at me more. They acknowledge my presence when I'm around them. When I'm with my kids, they're often saying hi to my children. And that is a very rare thing when I've gone to the park before. And so this has caused us to not only distance ourselves from other people, but want to engage them in ways that are positive for right now. And so we're learning all forms of communication that are brand new to us, doing Zoom calls for meetings all day. We're trying to figure this out, but it's a social thing. It's caused relationships to change and how we navigate them. And it's probably more than anything, a medical story. The heroes that are being championed around the world today are people who work in the medical field, doctors, nurses, hospital workers, first responders. They're not the celebrities that we often celebrate. They're not athletes. They're not the celebrities of actors and actresses on movie screens. We here in the United States live with some of the greatest medical care in the entire world, and that is a huge benefit to us. But just imagine having this kind of sweep around the world and living in India or in parts of Africa where medical care is limited or non-existent. This is a medical story. Here we can flatten the curve and hope that everybody that needs care is able to receive care. But in some parts of the world, nobody gets to receive care. In other parts of the world, could you just imagine how debilitating that would be, knowing that if you got this, that there was nothing that anybody could do to help you? That would be incredibly scary. And so I'm grateful to live where we are, but the way that this is a medical story is going to shape the future immensely in the months and the years to come. And humorously, this is also a haircut story, I think, because most of us have gone at least a month without a haircut, and I'm not sure I can go any longer. My hair can't get that much higher before it just starts to fall over. And some of you that are normally blonde or not blonde anymore, the hair stuff is growing out. That's what my wife tells me, at least. And so I think it's a haircut story because I don't know how much longer we can go before we're all going to look like you don't want us on a live stream anymore because it's just not going to look very good. But lastly, in a non-humorous way, I think this is a story about the death of individualism. That's what I titled the sermon this morning. Our lives have been completely uprooted from the norm. And in the process, we have given up, I think, one of the hallmarks of our society, one of the chief values of our society, which is the pursuit of individual freedoms and rights. We have been willing to give those up for the sake of others. I've heard it say from psychologists, I've heard this talked about in various different ways, that there's three things that human beings need in order to experience immense satisfaction in life. And there's three kind of equal things that we all need the same amount of, generally speaking. The first is that we need community. We are social creatures. We long to feel, to give, and to receive love. Number two, we need meaning. We want to know that there's a purpose to our lives. We want to know that our lives aren't just random occurrences. We want to know that we are driven by a greater story, that there's something beyond us in our individuality that matters in life. And then the third is we need freedom. We don't want somebody else from the outside dictating the way that we do our life. We long for individual rights so that we can do the things that we feel we're called to do. Up until about a month ago, it would have been easy to see in our society that there's one of these buckets, these three buckets of community, of love, and of meaning, of love, and of individual rights. There's one of these buckets that we have put all of our focus on. and that is the individual rights of freedom. We are overflowing with freedom in our society. We focus on being and doing anything we want. That's what our eyes or what our lives are focused on. No one is allowed to impede the expression of who we are. And so I think about like a circumstance that happened literally yesterday. I was getting on the freeway and I was in the lane that allowed me to continue going without anybody getting in my way. And the driver on my right sped up in front of me and cut me off. And I was immediately angry and frustrated because their freedom had impeded mine. And I don't want anybody impeding my freedom. That kind of anger that some of us get when we're cut off on the freeway or when somebody does something that we don't think is just or right that impedes us is that kind of feeling of angst of we should be able to do what we want to do. And so it's unthinkable that someone should ever get in the way of us being able to be free and do what we want to do. Thomas Merton said, "You are made in the image of what you desire." And so what he's basically getting at is that we become like what we long for. And I think what we have longed for in our society is the ability to be who we want and do what we want whenever we want. But in the process of focusing on life that way, we end up abandoning the other buckets of things that we need to experience satisfaction in life. We can't have love and community and relationships with others. Why? Because we're selfish and we're focused on ourselves. We can't have a higher purpose that we're focused on in our lives. Why? Because our lives or our eyes are totally fixed on our individual lives. We can't see beyond our own selves. And so this desire for freedom and for individual rights is partly why I think we see a low level of commitment from many people in society. Less people vote now than ever before. Less people get married now than ever before. Less marriages last a lifetime than ever before. Less people commit to a church. Less people serve in the community. Why is this? Well, the commitments that those things require often inhibit our ability or our desire to have autonomy over our lives. We want control. We want to be able to do what we want when we want it. And commitments make it so that we can't do that. Those things get in the way oftentimes. And so this desire for autonomy, where we allow ourselves to get ahead no matter how selfish we are, is normally like a driving force of our society until the last month. And I saw a news story right as this was ramping up, right after the stay-home orders were issued in Oregon. The New York Times ran an article about two brothers who had traveled all around the southeastern part of the United States buying up every bottle of hand sanitizer that they could find. And the New York Times ran this article about these two brothers. They collected all these bottles, and then they put them in a storage unit. And eventually, they were able to sell them as a third-party seller on Amazon. And they resold these bottles for anywhere from $8 to $70. Now, I don't know who is buying hand sanitizer bottles for $70, but somebody apparently did. It was not me. I hope it wasn't you. But the point here is that they made a lot of money really quick by having this idea of, hey, I think hand sanitizers are going to be worth a lot of money if we have a lot of it and nobody else is selling it. And so they started to make a lot of money, and that's when the New York Times article ran. And the state of Tennessee, where they were living and operating their business out of, the state of Tennessee got involved because what they were doing is known as price gouging, which is unethical at best and illegal in a time called a state of emergency, which had been issued in the state of Tennessee. And so the state of Tennessee cracked down, shut down their business, and they weren't able to sell any of their remaining products. Well, the story turns out like semi-positive because their remaining products they donated to a local church food bank and to first responders. And so they were able to give that all away. And it's kind of unclear moving forward what kind of penalties or potential jail time that they might be facing because of what they've done. But I just found the whole story interesting because under normal circumstances, we would look at what these brothers did and say, wow, they really saw forward and saw a business opportunity, a way to provide for themselves and get ahead in life by making a little extra money. At any other time, these would be savvy businessmen. But at this time, in this crisis, they've been receiving death threats. They've been called any number of horrible, awful things for what they have done. In a time of crisis, it seems like we're willing to give up our individual rights, our individual autonomy, for the sake of the common good, for the sake of the people around us. And why people were so furious at these brothers is because they were selfish. They were selfish. They were focused on their own individuality, their individualism. On Thursday, March 12th, here in our state, our governor issued what has been known as the Stay Home, Save Lives order, where many businesses were shut down. The government's call to action in this instance was a call to lay down your rights for the sake of others. It was really, I think, a call to love your neighbor, to love your neighbor, to give up your rights for the sake of others. The government wants us to act, I think, as I heard one philosopher describe it, they want us to act like citizens instead of consumers. A consumer looks at life and asks the question, what can I get out of this? A citizen looks at life and asks the question, what can I give? The government was wanting us to step outside of ourselves, to think about others, and to stay home for their sake. And while some Christians are frustrated by these stay-at-home orders because we're not able to gather at our physical church building, and they want to cry persecution and be frustrated at the government, I think this is actually an opportunity for the church to be the example to our society of what it looks like to love our neighbor in a time of a pandemic. We should be jumping at the chance to show people around us the love of Christ by loving our neighbor instead of ourselves. But this isn't a simple thing, right? This idea of loving your neighbor, of laying down your rights for the sake of others, this isn't just something that we can just do automatically. Denying ourselves is difficult to embrace. And so I want to look at this morning the story of Esther, the story of Esther, and the opportunity she had to put others first by laying aside her life and her own agenda. So if you have your Bible, you could turn to Esther chapter 4. And as you're turning there, I'm going to kind of give some backstory. Esther is in the Old Testament. If you kind of turn all the way past Chronicles into Ezra and Nehemiah, it's right after that. If you've gone to the middle into Psalms, you've gone a little bit too far. So Esther chapter 4, and as you're turning, here's a little bit of a backstory. The book of Esther finds God's people, the nation of Israel, in exile. They have been conquered by a foreign country and sent away from their homes. And so now they're being ruled over by the Persians. And there's a guy named Xerxes, Xerxes the First, who is the king. And he's married to this woman named Vashti. And he decides to throw a party at some point during his rule. And during this party, he's had too much to drink, a few too many glasses of wine, and he decides that, well, he has a beautiful wife, and so he wants his wife to come out and show how beautiful she is to everybody who's at the party. And she refuses. She refuses, and Xerxes is frustrated and kind of exacerbated by the whole thing, and his advisors are very concerned because they think, well, okay, if the queen can kind of stand up to the king, well, what happens if all the other women in our country decide that they want to stand up to all the other men? That could be a real problem. So we need to do something about this. And so they come up with this plan that is kind of like an old school way of divorce. They didn't have divorce so much back then, but they renounced her as queen, and the king is no longer the queen is no longer allowed to be in the presence of the king. She's been banished from the kingdom and power. Well, what happens next is that the king needs a queen. He needs a wife. And so all of the advisors go all over the Persian kingdom looking for young women that they can select, that they'll put before the king, and that he'll choose one. And so they eventually move to all these different towns, and they come to a place where there's a Jewish girl named Hadassah. Hadassah, who is more well-known for her Persian name, which is Esther. And she's selected because she's a beautiful young girl. And she's sent into this kind of like beauty pageant school where for a year, all they do, all of these women that have been kind of pooled together, just work on becoming more beautiful. Because eventually they're going to have to go before the king and present themselves. And the king is going to choose the most beautiful one. At least that's what he thinks. And at this point, we don't get the sense that Esther is really all that different from all the other women. Yes, she's Jewish, but she doesn't really seem to be embracing that. And even in the original language of the book, she kind of alternates between using her name Hadassah, her Jewish name, and her Persian name Esther, which kind of gives us this picture that there's this identity crisis going on in her own self about whether she wants to embrace her Jewish heritage about who she is, or whether she just wants to infiltrate and just be a Persian woman. So there's this battle going on. And the story continues that a year later, she presents herself before the king and she's selected to become the queen. And the king throws a huge party for her and everything's going great. Well, right around this time, her uncle, whose name is Mordecai, who's really like her dad because her parents have died, and so he's like a big brother slash dad for her. Right around this time, he's at the king's gate, like right outside where the king lives. And a government official named Haman arrives to the king's gate, and Mordecai doesn't bow before him, which is the rule. You're supposed to bow before the government officials. And Haman is furious, and he decides that he's going to come up with this plan to wipe out all the Jews. He wants to kill all the Jews because of Mordecai not bowing before him. And so he goes to the king, Haman does, and he says, you know what? I'm going to offer you all of this money, all of my riches, if you will allow me to kill all the Jews. And the king is dumb, and he says, I'm not going to take your money. I'm going to let you use that money to kill all the Jews. Go and do whatever you want. And Mordecai finds out about this. An edict's been issued that the Jewish people are going to be killed. Mordecai finds out about it, and he sits outside the king's gate, and he's in mourning. And Esther's advisors that are around her tell Esther about this. Hey, your uncle's outside the king's gate. He's in mourning, and Esther doesn't know why. She doesn't know about the edict against her own people, the Jewish people. And so she sends somebody to go to Mordecai and ask, like, what's going on? Why are you so sad? And Mordecai sends up the king's edict to Esther. And this is in Esther chapter 4, verse 11. This is Esther's response. She's just found out about the king's edict, and Mordecai wants her to do something about it. This is her response, verse 11. All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. And so what is Esther's response? Like, well, you know, this sounds like a really tragic thing for the Jewish people, but I can't just go to the king. I could get killed. And you know what? The king hasn't even asked for me to be in his presence in 30 days. So it's not like we have a really great relationship. So you know what? I wish I could do something, but sorry, there's nothing I can do. And that's her response to Mordecai. Well, that is given to Mordecai, and this is Mordecai's response back to Esther in verses 13 and 14. Mordecai says, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." And that question, who knows that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this, is really the theme of the book. It's the theme of the book. And the story continues on. Esther comes up with this plan that involves Haman and the king, and eventually she's victorious. She goes to the king and asks the king to spare her people, and he does. And Mordecai is actually raised to a position of honor, and Haman is killed. And so Esther is victorious. But the whole story really hinges on two different aspects, that I want to highlight. The first is divine providence. divine providence. And what's really interesting about this whole story is that nowhere in the book of Esther is God mentioned, not one time. And yet underlying everything that takes place, we get the sense that God is at work, from the bizarre divorce that the king has with the queen, from the beauty contest that's won by this young Jewish girl named Esther, to Mordecai somehow being able to overhear Haman's plan to wipe out the Jewish people. All this enabling this young Jewish girl, who is now the queen, to go to the king to spare her people. So even though God isn't mentioned at all in this story, we know that he's at work in everything that's happening. You see this even when Mordecai says to Esther, "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place." What Mordecai is saying is that God is going to take care of and provide for us. What you, Esther, have to choose is whether you're going to be a part of what God is doing. Here's how John Calvin describes God's providence. He says, "There is no erratic power or action or motion in creatures, but that they are governed by God's secret plan in such a way that nothing happens except what is knowingly and willingly decreed by him." Romans 8:28 says that God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love him. Proverbs 16:9 says, "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps." Even in the silence of not being mentioned in all of the story of Esther, we know that God is at work. He's providing, he is orchestrating behind the scenes. The story of Holy Week, which we just celebrated last week, moving from the crucifixion to the resurrection, teaches us that God's silence does not mean his absence or his lack of presence. He's there, even if we don't see him or hear him. In the second part of the story of Esther that I think is really important to see: first, divine providence; second, human responsibility. Mordecai says, "But who knows that you have been chosen for your royal position for such a time as this?" In other words, he's saying to Esther, you have to do something. God has set up the table for you, but you have to make a choice. We don't just live in a world where God drops us down and he watches us from afar, kind of standing back, seeing what happens. Nor are all of our plans dictated by God from the beginning. Instead, what God does is he partners with us in faith to allow his goodness to come through our lives as we submit ourselves to him. Romans 10 says that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved, meaning that even with God working behind the scenes, we must do the calling. There is something that we have to do, a responsibility that we have on our end. In the case of Esther, she had to go to the king. She had to take that leap of faith. She had to make a choice. Romans 14 says that all of us will one day stand before God and give an account of our lives. And that account is, well, what did you choose to do with your life? What was your life about? We have choices every day, every minute of every day, that ultimately decide what our lives are about. And someday we're going to give an account of those lives to the Lord. Those choices that we make every day, they show what our lives are about. And so what does this mix of Esther and divine providence and human responsibility have to say to our situation right now, these days that we face right now? I had just a couple thoughts of how we could apply this. And the first is that we should embrace the death of our individualism. Individualism is selfish. It's solely focused on ourselves. But if God promises to provide everything that we could ever need, want, or even imagine, if he promises our good, we don't need our individual rights. God says he will take care of us. And actually, Jesus is our example in this. Jesus went to the cross. He gave up his rights. He is our example. The nation of Israel wandered in the desert for 40 years. But in the process of those wanderings, God really brought out in them a mature people that was able to enter into the promised land. And I wonder if these days that we face are not our desert-like days, where we're letting go of our former ways to move into life without needing everything for ourselves, not needing us to be the most important person in the story, but allowing God to use us. And then the second is simply embrace the life of a citizen instead of a consumer. Like I said earlier, a consumer asks the question about life, what can I get out of this? A citizen asks the question of what can I give? What can I give? A consumer is the one who's hoarding hand sanitizer. A citizen is asking the question of what can I do? What can I do right now to make a difference in the lives of people? I know that in times of crisis that people are starving, are hungry for a bit of hope. They are searching and longing for something real, something tangible that can help them go through these difficult days. And we have that, friends, the good news of Jesus that can meet the demands that people have for life. We have that. And we have the security knowing that there's nothing that can take us down. There's nothing that we have to fear. The kingdom of God is with us and is secure with us. And so there's nothing to fear. And so with those things, we can be the people who love others by being focused on God and allowing his love to move through us out into loving our neighbors and those around us. We can proclaim the good news that Jesus is risen and that he is reigning for eternity. We can tell that to anybody who's willing to listen, because we have this secure place that there is nothing to fear, and the good news is ours to share. And so as we take some time to respond, the team's going to lead us in a few songs that really focus on the way that God has loved us, the way that God has loved us, and allowing his love to enter into us, enabling us to be transformed by him. So take a moment, wherever you are, on the couch, to join in with the team as they lead us in a few songs. Well, thanks for joining us this morning. As I thought about closing, I thought about Peter. Peter, who is a pretty passionate guy throughout his ministry and had a pretty obvious failure right around the time of Christ's death as he denied knowing Jesus 3 times. And as he first meets Jesus on the shoreline, Jesus asks him, "Do you love me?" And Peter responds by yes. And 3 times, Jesus says, "Feed my sheep." And eventually, I think Peter starts to figure out that his eyes have been solely fixated on himself. And he begins to lead in ministry by loving others and looking beyond himself. And as he writes in his New Testament epistle, 1 Peter chapter 4, at the very end of the first letter that he wrote, he said, above all, love others, love other people, and practice hospitality without grumbling. And so I think Peter's encouragement to me, to us, to you, is that we have this safe, secure ground of God loves us, that nothing can touch us, and that then, from there, we can abound in love toward others, practicing hospitality with social distance in a safe way, but by prioritizing others. And so that's really the encouragement that we have for you today. As we close out, I just wish your very best. We wish we could be together. We miss being with you. It is very odd to be in this space with just a few people on Sunday morning. And so it's going to be a great celebration when we can be back here again soon. But for now, we just wish you the very best. God's blessing in your lives. Thanks for being with us today.